Matthew chapter 16, and we will only get a little bit farther than we got last week because there are just things that are too heavy in the language of the late 60s. Too heavy to fast forward through them, and we're not in a hurry. We can go as slow as we want, right? Today is the day that's like every pastor's dream because the standard time goes back on and people have no excuse for being late and almost everybody's early. That's wonderful. It's a fabulous day. I started out with a pounding headache today, which has dissipated. Thank the Lord for that because everybody prayed for me. But we just get to look at wonderful passages of Scripture. We get to hear words out of Jesus' mouth. And Jesus said, when we learned and followed what he said, the way that disciples and followers learn, that the truth that we learn from him would set us free. And I won't ask for a show of hands, but I know because I've talked with many of you, the things that we have been hearing and learning from Jesus have been setting us free. And so it can always be. My prayer is that it would be true today as well. I'm going to start reading at verse 13 of chapter 16, just so that we get our sense of context. We stopped last week in Caesarea Philippi with Peter's confession of who Jesus was. We had a little bit of a preview that we were going to talk about what the foundation of the church is today and what it is not, which I think is just as valuable. I'm probably going to get somebody upset with me, maybe not. Sometimes when you say the things that Jesus says, it rattles people, it shakes their foundation. And if my foundation is not built on him, then it probably needs to be shaken. I just find all of these things that we're looking at today to be so liberating for me. Matthew 16. Verse 13, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? And they replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked, who do you say I am? And Simon Peter answered, by the way, that was a question asked to everyone that was there, for a personal opinion. Peter was the one that spoke up. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because this was not revealed to you by man or by flesh and blood, by human means, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter. The Greek word is the word Petros, which means a small fragment of stone or a pebble. And upon this rock, the Greek word is Petra, P-E-T-R-A, which is a large mountain of stone, like Gibraltar. On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it or prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. And I always write in parentheses, yet, because pretty soon he's going to tell them to go tell everybody. So it's a timing issue. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples. The Greek is a word that means to clearly explain something, to leave no room for doubt or to state something in such a clear way that it's unmistakable. And I point that out because it's going to be astonishing as we look over the next few chapters that he tells his disciples 8 times that he's going to be put to death. He says, who's going to put him to death? He tells him it's going to be gruesome. He says he's going to be killed. And then on the third day, he's going to rise again. And they forgot. 8 times he tells them. And there's something to be learned from that. From that time on, verse 21, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests and teachers of the law, the religious leaders of the nation, that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Is that clear? I mean, can it possibly be stated in any clearer terms? How you'd think you'd remember something like that, but they didn't. In fact, you'll see one reason in the very next verse why they didn't, because they really didn't hear what he said the first time. They had a different agenda altogether for Messiah. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord. That is a gigantic oxymoron, a self-contradictory statement. The Amplified Bible says, God forbid, Lord. This shall never happen to you. And Jesus turned and said, this is the same Peter that just a few minutes earlier was being commended for having deep spiritual insight revealed to him by God himself. Wow. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Sorry, can't say that without the evangelist voice. Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. That is a present tense verb. Right now, this minute, you do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of man. That right there is the perfect biblical definition of what it means to be in the flesh. That little phrase that Christians kick around, we talk about somebody being in the flesh, there's the definition right there. We'll talk about that today. And then Jesus said to his disciples, I think it's excellent to keep the context of this. If anyone wants to come after me, he must deny himself. These are requirements, by the way. The word must makes them requirements, not suggestions. He must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Because whoever wants to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he'll reward each person according to what he's done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. What did you mean by that? Well, stay tuned next week. Because the very next episode talks about that. We won't get that far today. We will get part of the way through that. We will be talking today about the church's foundation, and then we will be talking primarily about the different agendas that we often have. It's just such a perfect example of God having one idea, of people who say they're followers, and to be fair, they had dropped everything and were following as best they could. But sometimes even followers have a different idea about where he's going. My favorite quote about being a follower of Jesus is from Oswald Chambers. And he says, we cannot call ourselves followers of Jesus if we are taking the initiative. Because followers follow. Duh. I mean, but isn't that, that whole line of thinking doesn't go over well with 21st century American Christians. It doesn't go over well with Yankees. It doesn't go over well with guys. Or, you know what I mean? It just is foreign to our way of thinking. And so here you've got these guys, they did drop everything. Peter even exhibits the fact that he has a really good grip. He's thought it through, his heart has been open to what God says, and he realizes who Jesus is. But he does not, none of them did at this point, have a clue as to where the plot line was going. And what's worse, they were guessing. I would tell you that I've gotten in the biggest trouble in my life, not just because I didn't know where God was going, because you're not expected to know what you don't know. But in the not knowing, I was guessing. And I was putting all of my energy into following where I thought it was going to go. I remember talking with one of the young college men in my first church about, actually, he was part of the congregation, and I was talking about this whole idea of following Jesus one step at a time, every day, that it was meant to be a relationship day by day. He knows where he's going. All he wants is for me to stay close, be attentive, like the song we sang, so that he can whisper and I'll do what he says. And afterwards, I remember the guy came up and if you're listening to this, you know who you are. And he came up and he threw his Bible down in front of my stool up there on the little platform and threw it down. He said, let me get this straight. You mean, and then he basically repeated, actually what every teacher wants. He repeated in his own words exactly what I'd said. And I said, yeah, you got it. And he just threw up his hands and he said, but that would consume my whole life. And I said, there you go. But those were not words that he wanted to hear. Lots of different reasons why people come to Jesus. Sometimes they're just in such a pickle, they realize nobody but God can fix this. And so they come basically looking for God to get them out of the pickle that they're in. Some people realize God's got the biggest pockets there are. Nobody's going to really be able to bankroll their plan in the way that God can, so they kiss up to God to try to get God to bankroll their plan. And then sometimes we're just confused. We think he's going one direction, and that's why these, and he's not, and that's why these words are so important for us to look at and to take seriously. I have to do this every day. You'd think you're a professional, Bob. You know, I've said this last week, I'll say it again. I think that responsible people are the people who most often limit God. The people who are being responsible to doing what they think their job is are the ones that very often stop listening. Why listen? I'll just go do what I'm supposed to do. Ministers are no exception. These are followers of Jesus in name. But they don't understand that he's going to take a hard right up here just a little ways, and he's going to go in a direction that is not what they're thinking at all. And he's trying to prepare them. So what is the foundation that Jesus is going to build his church on? We touched on it a little bit last week. Peter, after they give the reviews of what popular opinion is, well, some people say, Jesus, that you are John the Baptist. By the way, all these guys are dead. John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, the prophets, they were all dead. It was obvious looking at Jesus, he was not normal. And so popular opinion in Israel was, He's one of these powerful men of God with distinctive ministries, and he's just risen from the dead because he's obviously not normal. He's not a normal carpenter. Nobody could do the things that he does without being somebody special. But Jesus asked that question that, as I said last week, is the most important question that he'll ever ask any human. And he doesn't ask us as a group. He asks us personally, who do you say that I am? Not what does your denomination say theologically about me, not what does your mom say about me, with the Republicans or the Democrats, or your comparative religions teacher at university. Who do you say I am? That's the operative question. And it's interesting that Peter blurts out this answer, and he's commended for it, having received it from supernatural revelation. But this is not the first time Peter ever said this. He said it a couple of times earlier. But when he said it earlier, it was a wowie, zowie kind of a thing after he witnessed miracles. And the one that got his attention the most was the miraculous, it's called the miracle of the miraculous catch. Remember, it was when they first met Jesus and they're out fishing just slightly offshore. They'd fished all night. And the carpenter waltzes up and yells out and says, "Hey, try throwing your net on the other side of the boat." I don't know. I would think I was being mocked if I'm a professional fisherman. I mean, how far away is the other side of the boat? We've been doing this all night. Somebody says, "He's a carpenter. He doesn't get it." But I don't know if you've ever been so desperate as a fisherman that you'd try anything. Rip off a piece of a wool sock and put it on the hook and throw that out because they're not biting anything else. The weird thing is they did throw their net out and they caught a huge number of fish. They couldn't even pull them all in. That was when Peter makes his first statement about God being involved in what Jesus did. A lot of people are that way about miracles. But it just doesn't last very long. "Oh God, if you'll just heal me of blank, or if you'll just heal my child or my mom of blank, or if we could just see a miracle." And then God does. And it fizzles out. I know people right now got very, very serious about God when they found out they had cancer. God was very merciful, and God healed them. And they came to church for a while, and now they're back out right where they were, with their freshly healed body, doing the same stuff they were doing. So miracles are not necessarily a real guarantee that you've really thought everything through about Jesus being the Lord, about who he is. And that's why Peter's commended. Because he's not just reacting emotionally. He's thought this through. He's in touch with God enough that God has revealed to him who Jesus is. And Jesus changes his name. I tried last week to describe it. There's no way that words could describe what it's like there in Caesarea Philippi. When we went, our church group, it was one of our favorite spots. Lots of rushing water and foliage, and you don't get foliage like that everywhere in Israel. But there's this huge mountain of stone. It reminded me of a smaller version of Half Dome in Yosemite. It reminded me a little bit of Gibraltar, the way that it's just a massive, large chunk of rock. And they're in this place refreshing themselves. And Jesus asks them this question, and Peter blurts out, "Oh, I believe you are Messiah, Son of the living God." And Jesus commends him and says, "I'm changing your name from Simon to Peter," which means a small fragment of stone, Petros, P P-E-T-R-O-S. And upon this Petra rock, this huge mountain of stone, in fact, if you have a study Bible or the Amplified Bible, it will say a rock like Gibraltar. It's a specific word for a mountain of stone. And picturing this in your mind, it's the perfect illustration. You can almost see Jesus pick up a pedal and saying, okay, you're blessed of God, you're listening to the Spirit of God, you know who I am, you're like this little pebble. What I'm going to build my church on is like this mountain of rock right here. What was the rock that Jesus was going to build his church on? I believe, I'm not the only one, that it was what Peter said. It was his confession of who Jesus is. That Jesus is the one that's going to build his church. And he's going to build it on himself, who he is. You're going to get a lot of really varying opinions about that, even from church people. I told you last week that I was going to talk for a minute. I have some notes. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about what the foundation of the church is not. And I think when we see this, as well as when we see that Jesus said, I will build my church, he didn't leave that responsibility to us. The church that the gates of hell will not be able to prevail against is the church that he himself builds, that is built upon him. I think then we can understand why the church is failing and has failed historically in so many ways. And I think the best four examples to use to talk about what the foundation of the church is not is to look at the four ministries that the disciples gave Jesus that were public opinions about who he was. John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. John the Baptist represented, he had a one-string guitar. He was a one-trick pony. His message was quite short. It was for a specific purpose, and it was all about repentance. It was about reform. Find out what is wrong with society. Expose it, and let's clean it up. And that was his ministry. Prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight paths. Get the junk out of the way so Messiah, who's here, he says, can come and walk right into your hearts as your king. And, of course, John was so into that and he was so blunt about it, it is ultimately what got him killed. I do not believe that is what the foundation of the church is to be. But there are people who believe that is to be the foundation of the church. We're to sniff out the sin in society, expose it, condemn it, and clean it up as best we can. Now, John the Baptist had a ministry given to him by God. So I'm not saying it was wrong what he was doing, but it's not to be the foundation of the church. Elijah's ministry was similar, but Elijah's ministry was marked by the miraculous. I know people, and we've had a few of them come through here, who believe that the foundation of the church is that we should be seeing the same miraculous things happen. When the church is together, we should see the miracles happen. Just as Elijah demonstrated God's power at a time when Israel was falling into idolatry. So Elijah just comes along and says, my God can beat up your God. My God can work miracles that out-miracle the miracles that your false gods can do. And that was very flamboyant. It got lots of people's attention. Isn't it easy to see how people could have thought that Jesus maybe was Elijah coming back from the dead, because he was working miracles that nobody had seen before? It's easy to see why people would think he was John the Baptist. Even Herod thought maybe he was John the Baptist, because Jesus had a way of exposing sin just by being there. Jeremiah. weeping over the lost sheep of Israel. Jeremiah's one of those guys. I would not like to have his job. Hardly anybody listened to him. God asked him to do some, I think, would have been really silly things to do to get people's attention. But Jeremiah was known as the weeping prophet. Kind of easy to see that at some points in Jesus' ministry where he wept openly at the rebellion of Israel, where he wept openly at the unbelief at Lazarus' tomb and all that death, the grief that death had brought. Easy to think why some people thought Jesus weeps over the lost. He's Jeremiah. Come back. This is one of those things I know somebody's going to get upset about, but I do not believe the foundation of the church is to be our feelings for the lost. The foundation of the church isn't to be evangelism. Evangelism is to come as a fruit of what the foundation of the church is. What about the other prophets? Well, all that had happened in the past was that when God had a special message to give to his people, he spoke through the prophets. And many people, they heard words, they knew that they were tying words that had already been spoken with things they'd never heard before, came out of Jesus' mouth, and they believed the message of God, the scripture, is the foundation. All four of those things were all ministries that were of God. All four of them. The exposure of sin, the miraculous as almost an everyday occurrence. The love for the lost, so much that it gets you in your guts and you weep.